evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Ford Hall Forum. We come this evening to a tradition at Ford Hall Forum, which is an organization rich in traditions. One tradition is that we always have a period where you, the audience, can question our speaker. Another tradition is that we are always free to the public. And that leads me to yet a third tradition, which is that we depend on the generosity of our members and our friends to help keep these programs going as they have for the last 80 years. So if you are a member, as I know many of you are, I thank you. And if you're not, I hope you'll consider joining or at least being as generous as you can when you leave. For many years, Ayn Rand spoke at the forum annually, drawing an ever larger audience, and it became, after a while, her only talk of the year. For the past 6 years, that tradition has been carried on by Dr. Leonard Peikoff. In 1951, some time ago now, Leonard Peikoff made a trip to California that was to change the course of his life. Through a friend who knew her, he was invited to the home of Ayn Rand, the novelist and objectivist philosopher. Thus began a friendship and a professional association that was to last until Miss Rand's death in 1982. Dr. Peikoff was chosen by Miss Rand as her legal and intellectual heir. Dr. Peikoff has been a professor of philosophy at many colleges and universities and has lectured at many places across the country, as well as coming here to Ford Hall Forum regularly. Currently, Dr. Peikoff is completing a systematic presentation of Ayn Rand's philosophy, which he hopes, he says, to have to the publisher by about this time next year. The next book he will be publishing is called The Voice of Reason, Essays in Objectivist Thought, which will be available by about Christmas. It's an anthology of 30-odd pieces, 10 of which are from past lectures here at Ford Hall Forum, 5 by Ayn Rand and 5 by Leonard Peikoff. It's with great pleasure now that I introduce to you tonight's speaker, Leonard Peikoff.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There's no bromide more common today than the statement that we live in a complex world. Whatever the subject of discussion, this claim is routinely offered at the outset as a kind of magic incantation, an all-purpose depressant. Its effect is not to inspire people to think, but to induce a sense of helplessness, weariness, hopelessness. It is used not to solve problems, but to assure people in advance that there are no solutions. The past, our leaders and cultural spokesmen often suggest, was different. Once upon a time, we could find straightforward answers to our problems and know what to do, but no longer. Life is just too complicated now for, here is the dread word, simple answers. The word simple itself has become the basis of a whole new condemnation contained in the modern term simplistic. When I argue with people, I hear all kinds of attacks from them. Thanks to my objectivist views, I am selfish, impractical, too idealistic, atheistic, and so forth. But the commonest attack by far is, you are simplistic. Simplistic is not the same as oversimplified. If you accuse someone of oversimplifying, you imply that it is all right to simplify, but one must do it rationally, not leaving out important factors. If someone accuses me of oversimplifying, I reply, tell me what I have left out. The modern charge simplistic, however, conveys the notion that it is not merely an issue of some omitted factor. It implies that the simple as such, is naive, unrealistic, bad. The term is an anti-concept intended to smuggle into our minds this idea. You have simplified something, and by that very fact, you have erred, distorted, done wrong. This amounts to legislating simplicity out of existence. I call this attitude complexity worship, and it is everywhere today. How should we deal with all the complex situations we encounter according to the conventional wisdom? The answer implicit in today's practice is by disintegration. In other words, break up the initial complex problem into many parts, then throw most out as too complicated to consider now, then throw some more out. Keep eliminating aspects until finally you get a narrow concrete on the table left to argue over. For example, schematically. Suppose some American businessmen are upset over Japanese sales in the U.S., which they feel are cutting into their own sales, so they go to the government to demand relief. Of course, if they came and asked me, I would say, you must decide first whether you advocate the principle of free trade or the principle of protectionism. And then I would offer a proof of the evils of protectionism, why it will harm everyone in the long run, American businessmen included, and why the principle of free trade will ultimately benefit everyone. That would be the end of the dilemma, and the people demanding tariffs would be sent home packing. But this kind of analysis would be ruled out by any congressional committee today or any academic commission studying economic problems. We cannot be simplistic, they would say, and talk in broad generalities like free trade or protectionism. How, they would ask, can we possibly make sweeping statements on this level that involve every country, every product, every group of consumers and producers, every era of history? Life is just too complex for that. Well, what then do we do in the face of such complexity? Basically, they answer, we have to narrow our focus tremendously. We must not talk about free trade in general, but free trade with Japan. And not just Japanese industry as a whole, of course, but only Japanese cars. We'll have to leave computers and TV sets for another committee to wrestle with. And we'll have to leave trucks out. That introduces too many tricky new factors. Just plain automobiles is enough to worry about. But maybe we should include small pickup trucks because they're pretty close to cars. Let's farm that one out to a subcommittee to study separately. And of course, we're not talking about forever here or even 10 years. We'll confine ourselves to a year, say, or even just this season, and we'll renegotiate the issue the next go-around. In the end, the question being debated is not, should we adopt a policy of free trade with foreign countries, but rather, should we place a 30% import duty on certain kinds of Toyotas and Datsuns for the next 6 months? Now we are told the question is not simplistic. Unfortunately, now it is also not rationally answerable. How is one to decide what to do in this case once one has thrown out the appeal to principles as naive? The answer is, you hold hearings. And all the lobbyists involved scream or bribe or make threats or otherwise exercise their wiles, and everybody offers contradictory compromises. The Toyota people say that 30% is unfair, but if we cut it to 20%, they will try, quote, voluntarily to sell less in the United States, while the Chrysler people insist that this is not good enough, but maybe they can pay their workers more if Toyota is really squelched. So the labor unions jump in and come out for a crackdown on Toyota, while the consumer groups are busy demanding more of the cheaper Japanese cars. What finally comes out of it all? Some kind of range-of-the-moment deal. a moderate squeeze on the Japanese, answered by a new Japanese retaliation against us, a new government subsidy to Detroit, a new agency to help consumers finance auto loans, a little bigger budget deficit, and another committee to review the whole situation again next month or year. After all, no policy, we are told, is set in stone. There are no absolutes. We have to be flexible, experiment, try and see. Philosophically, this is what is known as pragmatism. In this approach, there are no principles like free trade or protectionism. There are only concretes like Toyotas or Chryslers, and groups of people who fight over them with opposite desires. So the only solution is to find some temporary expedient that will appease the loudest screamers for the moment and then take a drink until the whole mess erupts again. It is no wonder that people who employ this method believe that life is complex and that there are no answers to any problems. But the paradox is that they use this method because they insist life is too complex for us to rely on principles. Now, some philosophical thought, some basic questions are clearly in order here. Is life complex? If so, does man have a rational, as against a pragmatic, means of dealing with its complexity? If so, do our leaders fail as badly as they do because they are rejecting man's proper means of dealing with complexity? My answer to all these questions is a resounding yes. My thesis this evening is, life is complicated, enormously so, but man has a conceptual faculty. A faculty of forming principles, which is specifically his weapon for coping with complexity. Yet our leaders, thanks to centuries of bad philosophy, distrust and reject this faculty, and are therefore left helpless to lead or to know what to do. Now let's begin by defining complex. In essence, complex is a quantitative idea. The complex is that which involves many elements or units, which are all tied together or interrelated. The simple, by contrast, is that which involves one, or at most a few, elements or units. For example, if the officials of the Ford Hall Forum want to attract a large audience, they have to untangle and grapple with many different issues. Whom should they invite? Does he have to be famous? What should he speak on? Will he agree to it? Can he condense his talk into 50 minutes? How will he fit into the rest of the year's program, etc.? Now this, we may say, is a relatively complex problem. By contrast, if the audience is here on the night of the talk, clamoring at the doors, and someone inside says, "What do we do now?" that is a simple problem. The solution being open up the doors and let the people in. Here we have no complexity, no complications, only one element to deal with. Now the first thing to note is that human life is inherently complex. Contrary to all the propaganda that we hear, this is not, underscore not, a distinctively modern problem. It is not a result of the Industrial Revolution, or the growth of population, or the fact of worldwide communication. All these developments have brought certain new factors into the equation of our lives, but they have also in many ways removed problems and difficulties, given each of us in many contexts fewer units to think or worry about, made life simpler. Compare the utter simplicity of feeding yourself today via a trip to the supermarket to get some frozen food versus the situation in the medieval days. Think how many different problems and questions and separate tasks would have been involved in that era for you merely to get to the point of having a dinner on the table fit to eat. Human life is complex in every era, industrial or not. Man always has countless choices to make. He has the whole world spread before him. He must continually make decisions and weigh results, keeping in mind a whole multiplicity of factors. Even in the most primitive times, the caveman had to decide what to hunt, how to do it, what risks to take, what weapons to use and how to make them, how to protect his kill, how to store, preserve, apportion it. And he had to do all this long before there was any science, long before there were any manuals or rule books to guide him in all these activities. In his context of knowledge, stalking his prey was an enormous complexity, no easier for him than our hardest problems in our advanced context are for us today to solve. Simplicity in the absolute sense is the prerogative only of animals. Animals function automatically to sustain themselves. They are programmed to act in certain ways without the need to go to work, produce wealth, choose among alternatives, weigh results. They merely react to some dominant sensation in a given situation. A dog, for instance, smells his bone and runs to get it. What could be simpler? But man cannot survive by reacting mindlessly to simple sensations. No human being can escape the problem of dealing with complexity and somehow making it simple and manageable. This applies to the modern pragmatist too, who makes such a fetish of complexity. But they try to solve the problem by reverting to the animal level, by narrowing their focus to some isolated concrete, like the dog reacting to the scent of a bone, while dismissing from their concern all the other concretes to which it is connected in reality. In other words, they solve the problem of complexity by throwing out, eliminating vast amounts of relevant information, thereby reducing themselves to helplessness. The proper human method is the exact opposite. We need to retain all the data we can, not eliminate. The more facts we can keep in mind in making any decision, the better off we are. But we need to retain all these facts in a dealable with form. We can't be expected to read or rattle off to ourselves, before every action we take, a whole encyclopedia of past human experiences, or even a single volume of tips, rules, and practical suggestions. Somehow, we must gather and retain a wealth of information, but in a condensed form. This is exactly what is accomplished by the distinctively human faculty, the conceptual faculty, another name for which is reason. Concepts are man's means of condensing information. They are his means of unit reduction. They are his means of converting the complex into the simple, while nevertheless losing no information in the process. Now let's take an example here, the concept man. If I utter the statement, all men are mortal, none of you has any trouble in understanding and applying it. You know what it means for your own life. You make up wills and buy insurance policies to cover the practical contingencies it involves. And you know that mortality applies to all men, past, present, and future. Here is a tremendous wealth of data, information about an unlimited number of units stretching across the globe from prehistory into the endless future, wherever there were, are, or will be men. And yet you have no trouble retaining this incredible scale of information in the form of the few words, all men are mortal. Do you do it by elimination, by narrowing your focus to only one or two men and brushing the rest aside as too complicated? Do you merely look at yourself and a few friends and say, I can't deal with the others now, life is too complicated, I'll appoint a subcommittee to worry about them? On the contrary, the key is precisely that you take all the units involved in man. You retain all the countless real-life instances, including the ones you've never seen and never will. And you put them all together into a single new unit, a super condensation, the term man, which integrates, combines, unites the totality. Of course, you accomplish this enormous feat by processing your perceptual data, by asking what do various entities have in common, what is essential to them, what differentiates them from the other things I see. For example, you grasp that in contrast to other creatures, men all share a certain kind of consciousness, the faculty of reason. So you set aside all the differences among men in height, hair color, fingerprints, intelligence, and so forth, and you reach the idea of a rational being and then designate this by a single term, man. The result is a vast complexity turned into a simplicity, a single unit. Now you have the ability to focus in one frame of awareness on all the cases it applies to. You can know truths about all of them because they come under man. They are subsumed in the same concept. Now, against this background, let us look specifically at principles. A principle is a basic generalization. In other words, it's a conceptual statement integrating a wealth of information about all kinds of concrete cases that we otherwise would be helpless to deal with or keep in mind. Yet we're able to do it by reducing all this information to a few words or even just a few letters like E equals MC squared. A principle is man's major form of using concepts, using them to reduce the complexity facing him while retaining all the information that is essential for successful action. There are principles in every field of human endeavor, and we rely on them continually. There are principles of physics, of chemistry, of agriculture, even principles of effective public speaking, which take countless experiences of past speakers and the effects they've had, positive and negative, with countless different topics on countless different audiences, and condense all of it into brief, intelligible rules to guide future speakers, such as motivate your audience, enunciate clearly, give examples, etc. In all these fields, principles are not controversial. Reason has been allowed its proper function and has been seen to be indispensable. In all the fields I mentioned, principles are not asked to compete with tea leaf reading or with divine revelations. But in the field of morality, the situation, tragically, is the opposite. In the whole realm of the humanities, we are still in the age of pre-reason. As a result, people do not see the need of concepts to decide moral questions. They do not see that the reason we need moral principles is the same reason we need principles in every realm. A moral principle is a basic conceptual statement enabling us to choose the right course of action. A proper morality takes into account all the real-life choices men must make. It tells us the consequences to expect from the different choices facing us. It organizes all that information for us by selecting the essentials. It integrates all the data into a handful of basic rules that we can easily keep in mind, deal with, and live by. Just as a single concept, man integrates all its instances into a single new unit. If you had no concept of man, you couldn't decide whether a new entity you meet is a man or not. If he is a lot taller and blonder than any you have seen so far, for instance, you would simply stare in confusion until you decided what is essential to being a man. In other words, until you conceptualize the relevant data. The same applies to evaluating an action. If you have no moral principles telling you which acts are right and which are wrong, what is essential to judging a given situation and what is irrelevant, how are you to know what to do and what to avoid? There are two opposite approaches to moral questions: the principled approach versus the pragmatist approach. The one tries to integrate, the other to disintegrate. The one tries to broaden the data he has to work with, to draw on all the relevant knowledge man has accumulated, to gain a larger vision and context for his answer, which he can do only by invoking man's means of condensing data, in other words, concepts. The other, the pragmatist, tries to narrow the database, to shrink the subject to the animal level, to reduce the units by staring only at some isolated percepts. Now let's apply this to an example. Suppose I ask, should you rob a bank? Now, I just do this in pattern, not in great detail. In pattern, the conceptual individual thinks a bank is someone's property. Now you see right away a broadening of perspective. He is looking for the abstraction it falls under, the concept that names its essence, property. And he grasps that in this respect, a bank is just like a home or a machine or a book or a pair of shoes. It's a creation that does not grow on trees, but has to be produced by somebody, which at once opens his mind to a flood of new data, to everything he knows about where books or shoes or banks and the rest come from, that they presuppose knowledge, inventiveness, independent judgment, diligence, work. All these observations are integrated and retained in his mind through a simple principle. Property is a product of human thought and effort, from which it becomes apparent that if men wish to live, they must have title to that product. They need the right to keep and use the results of their effort. Here is another principle which condenses and subsumes all our knowledge of the destructive results of depriving men of their property, not only through bank robbery, but through a thousand other methods besides. It covers what happens when men break and enter private homes, or raid farms, or establish social estates, or plagiarize manuscripts, or steal hubcaps. By the device of conceptualizing the action of bank robbery, in other words, reducing it to essentials and bringing it under principles, in short, we know how to evaluate it. We know that if such behavior is condoned or permitted, the principle involved in the long run will lead to destruction. You see the pattern. We're confronted by a concrete bank robbery, and we deal with it by considering only a relatively few units, the few principles I mentioned. Yet these contain all the information we have ever gathered about the relevant requirements of human life. And so we reach an immediate, decisive answer. Now, by contrast, ask a pragmatist mentality, should I rob a bank? And his first move is not to conceptualize, but to particularize. The immediate question that typically comes to his mind is, which bank are we talking about? Chase Manhattan? The 42nd Street branch? Let's not be vague and simplistic about this. And how much do you propose to steal, he wants to know. A big bank might not even miss $10,000. And who will you use the money for? Yourself? AIDS victims? The poor? Etc. Now, where are we? Having moved in this direction, having disintegrated the question, and treated Bank X as a special, unique case, how is he ever to decide what to do? Well, I think you know how, just the way bank robbers do decide. They ask, can I get away with it? Or more exactly, do I feel like trying to get away with it today or not? Once you abandon principles, once you dismiss as naive generalities such abstract concepts as ownership, property rights, honesty, justice, there is no way to decide concrete cases except by arbitrary feeling, either your own feeling or that of some group with which you identify. In other words, you have to end up using the same method of decision as we saw in the Congressional Committee investigating Japanese tariffs. Now observe the inversion, the reversal, being perpetrated here. The advocate of principles is the one who actually benefits from the vast data bank of life. He is the one who keeps in mind, in making a decision, the intricate network of interrelated factors and what the implications of his action will be for countless similar situations. He is the one who truly faces and deals with the complexity of life, yet he is accused of being simplistic. On the other hand, the pragmatist who scoffs at principles, the man who puts on blinders, eliminates most of the relevant data, and ends up staring at an isolated case without context or clue like a newborn baby, he is the one praised for appreciating the complexity of life and for not being simple-minded. Now, if ever I heard a big lie, this is it. The people who reject principles reject the human method of dealing with complexity. But since they don't have the animal way out either, they are left helpless. In the end, they have recourse only to raw feeling or gang warfare. It's deuces wild at that point. Anything goes. This is how our politicians are now trying to decide the life and death issues of our economy and foreign policy. If a man lives by principles, his course of action is in essence predictable. You know what to expect of him. But if a man rejects principles, who knows what he will do next? Observe that all our leading candidates today, Democrat and Republican alike, take detailed stands on every concrete you can imagine. They issue a separate position paper filled with clauses and statistics to cover every trouble spot in Washington and the world. Yet no one knows what they stand for or what they will do in office. No one can retain all these disintegrated concretes or add them up into a coherent, predictable direction. The candidates offer us an abundance of plans and suggestions, but there's no connection among their plans. No integration, no unifying principles, neither in domestic affairs nor foreign. Under these conditions, elections become a crapshoot. Especially when you remember that our candidates and leaders are masters of the pragmatic flip-flop, as it is now called. After all, we're told regularly, every concrete situation is unique, as it is. So what applied yesterday is not necessarily relevant today. The candidates and office holders themselves do not know what they're going to do or say next. They're not trying to deceive the country by cunningly concealing some devious ulterior motive. They are merely responding to the latest hole in the dike by sticking fingers in at random. In other words, without any principles to give them guidance. Thus, it is an outrage, said one candidate, I'm sure you know who I have in mind, it is an outrage to capitulate as President Carter did to the vicious Iranian kidnappers. And here is my plan, he said a little while later, for shipping the Iranians arms in exchange for hostages. Or Russia is an evil empire that no one should trust, he said, and here is the new arms treaty that I trust them to obey. Or let's get rid of some government departments, let's abolish the Department of Education, and a few years later, a new initiative from him. Let's have a Department of Veterans Affairs. Of course, even today's politicians feel the need to offer the electorate something more inspiring than shifting concretes. Typically, what they do is to use abstract words in their speeches without reference to reality. Not as principles, but as empty slogans, to be sprinkled throughout their oratory as garnish, committing them to nothing, yet sounding large and visionary. Words like peace, or love, or Americanism, or the public good. The most brazen practitioner of this, though certainly not the only one, was Gary Hart, with his periodic invocation of the need for, quote, new ideas, which no one could ever find in all of his detailed position papers. If we are to save our country, what we need is not better politicians, but the only thing which can ever produce them, a code of morality. A proper morality is precisely a set of principles derived from reality, reducing the vast complexity of human choices to simple, retainable units, telling us what kind of actions support human life and which ones destroy it. This is what a code of virtues and values should be. Primarily, it's guidance for the individual, and then in the social realm, it's guidance to a society on political or governmental questions. A man who acts on moral principle in this sense is neither a martyr, a zealot, or a prig. He is a man whose actions are guided by man's distinctive faculty of cognition. For man, principled action is the only effective, successful kind of action. Moral principles are not ends in themselves, they are means to an end. They are not spiritual luxuries reserved for so-called higher souls, nor duties owed to God or heaven. They are a practical, earthly necessity to anyone concerned with self-preservation. Now I want to make a further point. If moral principles are to function successfully in human life, if they are to play their vital role, they must be accepted as absolutes. You cannot be flexible about them or bend them according to your own or your group's feelings. You cannot compromise them. This, of course, is the opposite of the pragmatist viewpoint which dominates our culture. So I want to pursue this issue a bit. If we do, I think the role of principles in man's life will stand out even more clearly. Let us go back to our bank robber and imagine trying to reach a moral compromise with him. You, say, are the banker, and your first response is to tell the intruder to stop, that the property in question is yours. The robber says, "No, I want your money, all of it." At this point, instead of calling in the police or standing on principle, you decide to compromise. You agree, now without duress, as your idea of a moral resolution, to give the robber only part of the money he came to steal. That, after all, would show flexibility on your part, tolerance, compromise, the willingness to negotiate. All the things that we hear everywhere are the good. Do you see what this policy would mean and what it would lead to? In Ayn Rand's words, it would mean total surrender, the recognition of the robber's right to your property. Once you make this kind of concession, you leave yourself helpless. You not only give up some of your property, but also abandon the principle of ownership. The robber, therefore, gains the upper hand in the relationship and the power to determine its future. He gains the inestimable advantage of being sanctioned as virtuous. What he concedes in this compromise is merely a concrete. He foregoes some of the loot, temporarily. Temporarily because now there is no way you can stop him when he comes back with a new demand tomorrow. The same kind of analysis applies to every case of moral compromise. Here are a few more examples. Let's take one from foreign policy. Imagine a country with the means to defend itself, for example, Britain or France in the 30s, which capitulates in the name of being flexible to some of the arbitrary demands of an aggressor, like Adolf Hitler. That kind of country thereby invites more demands to be answered by more flexibility. Such a country is doomed until and unless it changes its fundamental policy. By conceding the propriety of some aggression, it has dropped the principle of self-defense and of its own sovereignty, which leaves it without moral grounds to object to the next depredation. Or turn to domestic policy. Suppose you accept the, quote, moderate idea that individual rights are not absolute. They may be overridden by government controls when the public good requires it. For example, when the public needs more welfare payments or more Medicare or more censorship of obscenity or you fill in the blank. In this case, you have agreed with the collectivists that individual rights are not inalienable, that the public good comes above them. In other words, that man exercises certain prerogatives not by right, but by the permission of society as represented by the government. If so, the principle of individual rights has been entirely repudiated by you in favor of the principle of statism. In other words, in the name of achieving a compromise between clashing systems, the essence of one, capitalism, has been thrown out, while the essence of the other, socialism, has become the ruling absolute. Or take a final example. A judge who tries not to be too, quote, extremist in regard to justice. He decides to modify justice by a dose of political favoritism now and again under pressure from the bosses of the local clubhouse. Now you see that he has thereby dropped the principle of justice. Justice cannot countenance a single act of injustice. What sets the terms of this judge's compromise, therefore, and decides his verdicts is the principle of favoritism, which permits whatever whims the bosses authorize, including even many verdicts that are not tainted when this is politically palatable to them. In such a court, a fair verdict is possible, but only by accident. The essence of the system and its ultimate result is the elimination of fairness in favor of pull. Either you accept a proper principle, whether it's individual rights, self-defense, justice, or any other, as an absolute, or not at all. There is no man's land between opposite principles, no middle of the road which is untouched by either or shaped equally by both. The fact is that man cannot escape the rule of some kind of principles. As a conceptual being, he cannot act without the guidance of some fundamental integrations. And just as in economics, bad money drives out good, so in morality, bad principles drive out good. To try to combine a rational principle with its antithesis is to eliminate the rational as your guide and establish the irrational. In other words, if, like Faust, you try to make a deal with the devil, then you lose to him completely. And Ayn Rand summarized this point by saying, quote, in any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit, unquote. The reason for this is not that evil is more powerful than good. On the contrary, the reason is that evil is powerless and therefore can exist only as a parasite on the good. The good is the rational. It's that which conforms to the demands of reality and thereby fosters man's life, along with all the values life requires. That kind of policy acquires no advantages whatever from its antithesis. To continue our examples, a banker does not need the help of a robber who is trying to loot him. Nor does a free country need the attacks of an aggressor. Nor does an individual seeking to sustain himself need the jails of a dictator. Nor does the administration of justice benefit from subversion by corrupt bosses. By its very nature, the good can only lose by trafficking with the evil. The evil, however, is in exactly the opposite position. The evil is the irrational. It's that which contradicts the facts of reality and thereby threatens man's life. That kind of policy cannot be upheld as an absolute or practiced consistently, not if you want to avoid immediate destruction. Evil has to count on some element of good. It can exist only as a parasite, only as an exception to the virtues on which it's reliant. The irrational has everything to gain from the rational, a share of its achievements and values. A producer doesn't need a robber, but a robber does need the producer on whom he preys. And so do robber nations need freer countries, which they seek not to annihilate, but to rule and loot. And no collectivist wants to throttle every act of individual self-assertion, not even the Nazis or the communists. They need men to think and act as individuals to some extent, or their own regimes would collapse. And no political boss seeks to reverse every proper verdict. On the contrary, the boss mentality counts on the appearance of justice so that men will respect and obey the courts so that then, when he wishes it, the boss can intervene behind the scenes and cash in on that respect. Evil, in short, is not consistent and does not want to be consistent. What it wants is to get away with injecting itself into the life-sustaining process, sometimes short-range, out of context, by arbitrary whim. To achieve this goal, all that it needs is a single concession by the good, a concession of the principle involved, a concession that evil is proper sometimes. Such a compromise is evil's charter of liberty. Thereafter, the irrational is free to set the terms and spread by further whim until the good and man is destroyed. The power of the good is enormous, but depends on its consistency. That is why the good has to be an issue of all or nothing, black or white, and why evil has to be partial, occasional, gray. Observe that a liar, in common parlance, is not a man who always conscientiously tells falsehoods. There is no such creature. For the term to apply to you, a few venal whoppers on your part is enough. Just as a hypocrite is not a man who scrupulously betrays every one of his own ideas. Just as a burglar is not a man who steals from everybody he meets. Just as a person is a killer if he respects human life 99.9% of the time and hires himself out to the mafia as an executioner only now and then. The same applies to every kind of corruption. To be evil only sometimes is to be evil. To be good is to be good all the time. In other words, as a matter of consistent, rational principle. This is why objectivism is absolutist and why we condemn today's cult of compromise. These cultists would achieve the same end result, these fervent champions of compromise, more honestly by telling men without equivocation to eschew the good and practice the evil. Evil is delighted to compromise. For it, such a deal is total victory, the only kind of victory it can ever achieve, the victory of plundering, subverting, and ultimately destroying the good. Why should one act on principle? My answer is, in the end, you cannot avoid it. Some principle always wins. If the right principles, the rational ones, are not conscious, explicit absolutes in men's minds, then their evil opposites take over by default and ultimately win out. That is why in our pragmatist, unprincipled age, all the wrong principles are winning. And we see every form of irrationality, cowardice, injustice, and tyranny sweeping the world. It's not enough, therefore, merely to act on principle. Man needs to act consciously on rational principles, principles based on the facts of reality, principles that promote and sustain human life. If you accept irrational principles, such as religious dogmas or mystical commandments, by contrast, you will find that you can't live by them consistently, precisely because they are irrational and clash with reality. And you will be driven to pragmatism in despair as your only alternative. For example, if your moral principle is self-sacrifice, you can't expect to follow it consistently as an absolute, not if you want to stay alive. Remember that a principle integrates countless concretes. If you tried really to practice as a principle the injunction to give up your values for the sake of God or others, think what such a course would include and demand of you. Give up your property, others need it. Give up your pursuit of happiness, you're not here on earth to gratify selfish desires. Give up your convictions, who are you to think you know the truth when God or society, who are your master, thinks otherwise? Give up your choice of personal friends, you're supposed to love everybody, above all your enemies. That, after all, is a real act of sacrifice. Give up your self-defense. You're supposed to turn the other cheek when Russia takes over Nicaragua or Florida. Even if you decided to renounce everything, to become like the medieval saints, mortify the flesh, drink laundry water, sleep on a rock for a pillow, so long as you are motivated by any personal value, even if it's only eternal joy in heaven, and nothing here on earth, you're still condemned because that's selfish. Who could follow such a code? who could obey day by day in all the concrete situations of life such a rule? No one could and no one ever did. Yet that is what would be meant by accepting self-sacrifice as virtue, in other words, as a moral principle. What then have men done in the face of such an inverted moral code? Instead of running from it in horror and proclaiming an ethics of rational self-interest, they have accepted the creed of self-sacrifice, but quickly add that of course there are no absolutes, and you have to compromise and be moderate in order to survive. In other words, they preach irrational principles, then half practice, half evade them. So it's no wonder they're filled with terror at the prospect of acting on principle. If you hold irrational principles, your principles become a threat to your life. And then compromise and pragmatism become unavoidable. But that too is no answer, it's merely another threat. The only solution is a code of rational principles. A logical, scientific approach to morality. An ethics based on reality. Not on some supernatural fantasy or some arbitrary social convention, but on reality. This leads us directly to the base of philosophy, metaphysics, on which ethics itself depends, and to the principle that underlies all other principles. I mean the principle that there is a reality, that it is what it is, that it exists independent of man, and therefore that we must recognize the facts of reality, like them or not, and live accordingly. This is the fundamental principle that any rational approach to ethics presupposes. Morality consists of absolutes only because it's based on facts, which are absolute. On the other hand, if you say that there is no reality, or that reality is anything you or society want it to be, then there are no moral principles either, and no need of any. In this kind of setup, all you have to do is assert your arbitrary wishes, whatever they are, no matter how bizarre or contradictory, and the world will fall into line and satisfy you. This is the actual foundation of the pragmatist viewpoint. Pragmatism as a philosophy does not start by attacking moral principle. It starts by denying reality. It rejects the very idea of an external realm of facts to which man must adhere. Then it concludes anything goes. There are no absolutes. There's nothing to stand in our way anymore. I can't keep my glasses on in the heat. Now, am I exaggerating here? Last month, I was speaking at a convention of philosophers in Oregon. The man who spoke before me on the program was a philosopher who moved a few years ago to Washington, D.C. to work for the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities. At one point in his talk, he explained to the audience what he called, ironically, the metaphysical lesson he had learned from dealing with Congress. The people he met in the halls of Congress, he began, often wore buttons announcing this lesson explicitly. The buttons read, "Reality is negotiable." When he first went to Washington, he said, he had thought that politicians began the legislative process by studying the facts of a given problem, the data which were an indisputable given and had to be accepted, and that they then proceeded to debate which policy was appropriate given these facts. What he observed, however, was that congressmen would come to the bargaining table with their policy decision long since made, and then rewrite any facts that stood in the way to make them fit in with this preset decision. For example, if a Republican objected that a new social program was too expensive and would increase the budget deficit, the Democratic aides would be sent off to redo the projections for next year's tax revenues. They would jack up the expected GNP, or project a new rate of interest, or come up with some other prediction that would ensure that, in their new calculations, everything would come out just as they wanted, and no budget deficit would result. The Republicans, of course, accepted this approach and operated by the same method. Now, you might ask, what about the real numbers, the real predictions, the real facts? Who knows and who cares, you would be answered. Reality is negotiable. Now, these buttons allegedly are an in-joke, but the tragic fact is that it is no joke. The wearers in Washington learned the message that they are flaunting, learned that message in all their Ivy League schools, and they believe it, a fact proved by their actions, which are not merely concrete-bound, but militantly so, or as we may put it, which are not merely unprincipled, but unprincipled on principle. How do you fight a mentality like this and prevent it from leading us to disaster? You need to begin on the deepest level. You need more than a code of ethics. You need a philosophy that recognizes and upholds reason, a philosophy built on the fact that facts are not negotiable, that what is. Now that statement, what is in one sense the most complicated statement you can utter. It pertains and applies not just to every man or dog or star, but to everything. Everything that is, was, or ever will be. It gives us, in effect, the result of a tour of the entire universe in the form of three brief words, which, if you understand and accept them, fix in your mind and make available to you for all the rest of your life the essential nature of existence. That is the most eloquent example there is of our conceptual faculty at work, expanding incalculably the range and power of our minds, reducing complexity to simplicity by the power of principle, in this case, metaphysical principle. Nothing less can give men the means to live in the world successfully or the foundation to act on moral principle. Why should one act on principle? The deepest and final answer is for the same reason one should jump out of the path of a speeding truck. Because if one doesn't, he will be squashed by an unforgiving nemesis, an absolute reality. Thank you.
Question period, Dr. Peacock will be back in the lounge as you enter for a few minutes to answer a few more questions and perhaps to sign a few books. The other is that I did offer to stand up during this period and he chose to remain where he was. Now, who would like to start? Right here. The question is, what is the update on the movie Atlas Shrugged?
Well, I can tell you this much. A writer has been hired just prior to the writer's strike, which prohibits him from writing. So no further progress will take place until the strike is completed, but they are projecting a preliminary draft of a script for the movie 4 to 6 months from that date. And then from there, it's getting a star and director and then production, so it's several years past that point. I can tell you the writer's name if it means anything to you. His name is John Hill. He's had considerable experience in the field. I will also tell you one thing, just so that you will have some sense of reality not being negotiable. One of the first things that he said to me when I met him was, did I appreciate how radically different a movie would have to be from the novel? And I said, well, I think so, but what did you have in mind specifically? And he said, well, on a strictly on a quantitative basis, There's something over 1,000 pages in the novel, and in the time for a 2.5-hour movie, which is what they're aiming at, is a 150-page script. So he said, strictly mathematically, we begin with the understanding that 9/10 of the book has to be omitted. Now, I'm pointing that out to you now. It's going to be years before this movie is on the screens, but it might be a good idea to start that idea circulating at this stage of the history.
It's right here.
In a lot of situations, it seems to be more than one principle that can lead possibly to different actions. I'll give you two examples. Let's say you want to buy a very beautiful operatic record, and you look everywhere, it's only made to hunger. So you value your life and your happiness, you don't want to support a dictatorship. Let's take a second example. What do you do if you're the State Department, the rational State Department, and a country that is very much anti-Russian and pro-American in its current policy, and yet dictatorship of the so-called right wing? What do you do that seems to involve different principles or opposite principles? How do you decide which principle takes the primacy?
The questioner asks about situations in which two principles seem to conflict. He gives two examples, of which I think I can do one. If you are in the State Department, and are dealing with a country which is very supportive of the U.S. and in many respects very good, but is also a dictatorship at home.
I don't see what the conflict is there. I don't believe in trade with communist countries. I don't believe in purchasing from communist countries, even if they do make a product that I like or admire, so I don't have any conflict in regard to the Hungarian situation. The other aspect of your question was, what if you're managing a rational foreign policy and you are not in charge of another country, and it's either a communist dictatorship or a right wing? By right wing, I assume you mean the ordinary authoritarian, non-totalitarian, not Nazi, but just the ordinary South American type of situation. It's no question of a conflict of principles, and what should be your principles? Your only principle in foreign policy is self-defense. That you have to have an egoistic foreign policy in the same principled way as you have to in living your own private life. Communism is an expansionary international threat avowedly out to destroy the world and to take over the United States. One of these local dictatorships spends its whole time fighting off, you know, the next authoritarian is going to replace them and is no threat to outsiders. I certainly don't say we should encourage that. On the other hand, I don't think the United States should in that way be the world's policeman and go around and try to establish laissez-faire around the world. We have no means to do that, and no, it would be immoral to take our citizens' money to go around and try and spread good government lessons, which bureaucrats would be the last people in the world to be able to do anyway. Therefore, I would say in a situation like that, you have to identify, according to one principle, which is not in conflict, what does your self-defense require? And if it is, as in Nicaragua, for instance, a communist dictatorship close to your borders against some not very inspiring contra-freedom fighters, and there's some way you can aid them, I certainly absolutely would do it. I would not, however, do it on a pragmatic, ad hoc basis the way it's being done. In other words, I would not have summit meetings with Russia, praise the new leader, send who knows what to Red China, appease, trade with, placate, and sign deals with communists all over the world, strengthen them everywhere, and then say, we draw the line in Nicaragua. I mean, that is fantastic. No wonder, you know, no such policy has any credibility. But that is caused by an absence of principles, not by a clash of principles.
Another question. Yes, sir.
Yes, concerning the so-called problem of philosophical induction, what is the basic underlying epistemological principle that justifies or validates inductive inference or induction in general?
What is the epistemological principle that validates inductive
inference?
Well, I mean, that is really like asking, what is, give me fill me in a little Reader's Digest level background of the theory of relativity. That's the most one of the most tricky and complex questions of epistemology. I can give you an answer, but I don't think the answer would do you any good, because it's in very broad generalities. But metaphysically, induction rests on the law of cause and effect. It rests on the fact that Hume is wrong, that, you know, it's just good luck that the sun keeps rising, that there is a reason why things happen, that entities act a certain way according to their natures, and that therefore, assuming we take an appropriate sample, we have a right to predict the future on the basis of the past. It's not all, quote, contingency and chance. Then the question becomes, how do you know when you have taken the appropriate samples and the thing you have reached is the true generalization? And the answer to that in a word is, it has to be integrated in any given context of knowledge with everything else you know that's relevant. It has to tie into every other thing that you know that's relevant. But to illustrate that and make that plausible would be an hour for a brief example in a volume, so I'll have to let it go at that.
Question over here down in front of the coat.
You mentioned that you gave a talk recently for the American Philosophical Association. I wonder what the reaction to that was.
The questioner...
And what the subject was.
The questioner asked about the subject of Dr. Peacock's recent talk with the Philosophical Association, what their reaction was.
The subject of the talk was a symposium titled Philosophy and the Real World Out There. And the implicit subtitle was, Is There Any Connection? One professor of philosophy, as is customary in these symposia, delivered a paper, and then three of us were asked to deliver comments on his paper, and then he got to respond to our comments, and then there was questions. That was the format. He gave a very interesting paper, the original presenter, in which he said many true and very cutting things about the state of current philosophy. He is an analyst, if you know what that means. He's a philosopher in good standing among today's philosophers. And he said that they were scholastics cut off from life, that they were bizarre personalities, highly psychopathological. He lit into them on many perfectly legitimate grounds. And he had some very eloquent things in his paper. He said, we've heard of a ship of fools, but our profession is the first, which is a whole fleet of fools. So I went encouraged. You all circulate your papers in advance, so everybody knows what they're saying. And I gave as my assignment to pick up where he left off, basically, and say, I agree entirely with his description. But he didn't say why things are this way, and then give an account of the roots in Kant and preceding philosophy that led to this disastrous state. The two speakers who came after him and before me were very witty. They had a lot of really funny anecdotes. But they treated it more or less as an after-dinner speech. And the audience was receptive to that. They were definitely, unequivocally not receptive to me. A sizable number got up and walked out as my name was called. And they kept walking out as I continued. There were only a handful of actual philosophers left by the time I finished. And I had not expected popularity, and I certainly did not gain it by the time I finished. The only end to the story is that when the original presenter came to answer my comments, he said, as to Leonard's comments, I hadn't really wanted to get into philosophy this afternoon. So I would summarize it in one word, it was a fiasco.
The questioner says, and the question is South America, Central America, is Dr. Peacock saying he would encourage a dictatorship in order to keep out socialism? And if so, is that not a hypocritical statement?
No, that is not a correct statement. It depends what you mean by socialism, and it depends what you mean by dictatorship. If you mean totalitarian dictatorship, then I think that poses a major threat, because that's an ideological phenomenon. It poses a major threat to any surrounding countries and ultimately to all other countries. And it becomes a question of self-defense that it's proper to attack it. If you mean by dictatorship a local authoritarian gang, whether they preach socialism or what they preach doesn't make any difference to me. But they are not themselves ideologically committed to aggression against the rest of the world. And the alternative, remember that you are not in a position to dictate the alternatives available to people in foreign countries. You don't educate them, you don't give them philosophy, you have nothing to say in that way. They're simply there and they have their own choices. If you decide that the only choices that are offered in this situation by the people in that area are a bad gang that will kill each other, or a worse one which will kill you. If that is the way it stands, then you have every right in the world to do whatever you can to stop them from killing you. Now, some of the countries that are called socialist, like England, are obviously no threat. And I would certainly not say we shouldn't advocate a dictatorship in place of socialist England. I'm talking about a totalitarian, aggressive manifestation as against the local authoritarian gang. And I'm saying, ideally, if there's no threat, let them fight it out themselves. I strongly believe in America first, and in what used to be called isolationism. In other words, let the rest of these countries do whatever they want to, and the only thing that you have to do to set the right tone in foreign policy is to be a free country yourself. And the sheer power of your example will, and the fact that you're prepared to stand up to incursions against your rights, will carry the rest of the civilized world with you, as Britain has proved in the past. But now, of course, nobody does, so they're all, nobody stands up, so they're all running wild. But there's no contradiction or hypocrisy in this. That's it. Yeah.
Yes.
When the Soviets shot down the South Korean passenger plane a few years ago, one observer from a foreign country on the campus of an American university at the time said most of the students could not grasp the principle of how dangerous it is when a totalitarian regime gets away with arbitrarily initiating force against innocent people, nor could they see the principle that it's morally correct to use counterforce if you're going to defend freedom. Many of the students were openly relieved when President Reagan said there would be no active retaliation. You think such citizens are likely to fight for their republic when push comes to shove? And if not, you think the fault lies more in their grasping false ideas like pacifism and relativism, or in their inability to think in principles at all?
Can you condense that?
Without trying to repeat that, the questioner is asking about students, future citizens, or citizens who don't understand the dangers of totalitarianism and believe in relativism, pacifism, and such ideals. And he cites the example of when the Russians shut down the Korean airline a few years ago, students not understanding the dangers inherent in that situation.
I am not optimistic about the philosophic, or let's call it mental state, of American schools or students. I think that they're minds are being undercut and in many ways subverted and poisoned by the things that they're being taught. And I certainly do not think that they have any longer got the strength of conviction, of moral righteousness, of the value of this country that, for instance, their equivalents had at the time of the Founding Fathers. There is no question in the world in my mind but that we have what they would call in the 18th century a debased posterity. They would never have dreamt that things could reach the state of affairs that it is in today. Not that I think the students in grade school are the ones primarily responsible. They're the victims who've started off in progressive schools and then just been taught all this stuff ever since. So they're basically brainwashed, they're helpless, but nevertheless, I do think that students like that pose a threat, and I don't think that the situation can go on indefinitely. On the other hand, I don't think that they are necessarily repositories only of their teacher's viewpoint, because if they were, we would long ago have become a complete a totalitarian dictatorship in this country. We have, after all, a tradition in this country which has some weight and some influence still. There is the fact that what they're being taught is wrong and reality counts for something. And I do think, therefore, that there's also the people that don't have heavy schooling. You know, the people that don't go to the universities and are not thoroughly penetrated and corrupted by propaganda. So from that point of view, I wouldn't despair of the country as a whole. But I do, and I couldn't make a prediction if what you want me to say is, will they or won't they? I would say, and my guess would be like this, as and when and if it gets to the point that it is perceivably a threat here and now to us, the present generation would certainly stand up to a threat. But the more long range, the more it involves grasping principles, the less they're able to see. And in a way, I don't blame them, because this country has gone into venture after venture, like Vietnam, for instance, for no reason whatever, selling it to the kids who are, after all, the ones who are going to have to die in these ventures, without any tie to self-defense, without any attempt to justify why this is vital to American security. And many of these ventures have not been necessary to American self-defense, and all of it conducted without any foreign policy principles at all. So in that context, it's understandable that people, grade school kids, if presidents can't grasp it, why would you expect grade school kids? I would feel safer if it came to defending this country to take the instincts of kindergarten than the instincts of Congress, if I had to put one against the other. But I still couldn't make an exact prediction on what any given group is going to do at a given time. I do want to answer one implication of your wording. You said, is it that they have accepted relativism or they're unable to think in principle? Nobody accepts relativism as a principle except really corrupt professors. Relativism is their way of not thinking in principle. Relativism is their way of saying there are no answers to questions. Everything has to be judged as a concrete. What was true of this case is not true of that case. So it's not that they have a passion for a false epistemology. They just don't think in principles. And then you from the outside describing that call that relativist.
Yes, right
there. Do you think the Algerians made a good deal when they allowed the terrorists to get away in exchange for life with the hostages?
I don't think that you can answer a question like that out of the context of how the situation came into being. Oh, I'm sorry.
The questioner asked if you thought that Dr. Peacock thought a good deal was made when the Algerians exchanged the terrorists recently for the lives of the passengers of the plane, and what principles were involved?
to give you a short answer now that I've had a second, instead of giving you a whole lecture on the need of foreign policy, I would make a deal with the kidnappers to let, as long as I controlled the plane that they were escaping in. And as soon as the people were off, I would renege on the deal and execute the kidnappers summarily. And if that were logistically not possible, I would have every kind of identity on them and a secret police trailing them until they were shot down, every last one. These people are actual murderers who killed two, and theoretically they're supposed to be the ones who were responsible for killing the Navy, the American, from a preceding hijacking. So you could do anything in the world. You could make any deal in the world with them, promise them the moon, and then shoot them down in cold blood, and you are being entirely moral. The immorality is to let them benefit in any way. The way Ayn Rand put it is, morality ends where a gun begins. Now, it's still the case that this is not a satisfactory answer, though. You still need a whole speech, but not from me here, on what is it that got us to this position? How can it be that the world is in such a situation that there are continuous terrorist bands? And why is it that the government, which knows where these bands are emanating from, will not do anything about it? Now, the answer to that, of course, is a whole philosophy discussion in and of itself. So I don't want to turn this into a discussion of foreign policy. But that's what I would say on that example.
Back here in the middle.
Dr. Peacock, many people may want to abstain from voting in the upcoming presidential election as a protest. I was wondering if you care to suggest a possible write-in candidate or even write-in phrase or expression based on...
Well, as it looks right now, I am certainly going to abstain. I wouldn't go for either of the front or back runners of either party. I don't see anybody that remotely aspires to the stature of the last person that I voted for. I would, if you want to write in, the only one I can think of would be George Washington. But I mean, that's not the way to make a practical protest, because you just won't run up a big enough tally to get in the press.
I have a question way in the back.
Tell us how your love of painting is different from that of Madeline Murray O'Hare.
The questioner asks how Dr. Peacock's form of atheism differs from
Madeline
Murray O'Hare.
Yeah, well, for her, it is the substance of a philosophy. For objectivism, it is merely a side issue, the rejection of one error. She, her, as far as I know her view, her whole viewpoint is centered on there is no God. And if you believe that, anything else and everything else goes. Now, objectivism rejects God only as one way of upholding the supremacy of reality, but there are many, many other ways of denying reality beyond believing in God. And I gave an example in my talk from people who are certainly not religiously oriented, these congressional aides. Far more anti-reality than the old-fashioned believers in God in many cases. So it's a question of a philosophy has to be a positive, not a negative. And it has to be an entire system, not a single tenet. It has to be a view of reality, of knowledge, of values, of politics, of art. And to my knowledge, all that she has to offer is one negation. And the only thing I ever read by her had a fair amount of obscenity in it, which she seemed to think was connected with her atheism and showed, therefore, the defiance of all standards, including the standards of civilization. Objectivism certainly does not accept that. We do not reject God as a means of rejecting the establishment. We reject God as a means of affirming reality, and the focus is on the positive affirmation, not on that one negation.
Question right there.
What do you think the principles of Alan Greenspan are?
The questioner asked, what do you think the principles of Alan Greenspan are currently?
I'm going to pass on that one because they're announced in the newspapers on a daily basis. So you can decide for yourself. You have exactly the data that I have to decide that question.
We'll take a couple more questions and we're going to take
a break. Given your response to your talk at this recent Philosophical Association, what prompted you to speak there? Did they invite you?
Yes.
The questioner just asked, what prompted Dr. Peacock to speak at this Philosophical Association recently?
Rather, what prompted them to invite you?
Or what prompted them to invite you?
Well, you think that's so astonishing? Well, the man in the charge of the program committee had read my book, The Ominous Parallels, and he agreed with sections of it, and in fact agrees with good parts of Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. And he felt, and he treated me very fairly, that objectivism should be given a hearing, but he forgot to tie the audience down. I do not know enough German history. I'll save you repeating that. Can I just make a general statement here that you have to distinguish causes of complex effects? Industrialization was a world phenomenon in the West, and it is not inherently tied to a particular political situation in Germany. And in fact, the leading industrial country was ultimately America, the richest and most powerful, which was the freest. But I'm sorry for injecting that. But
we'll take one last question, gentlemen, and what's your take?
In a novel, I meant that once we begin the sentence begins, that I wish to warn you. Does this mean that one must never forgive he who acts against some
people? The questioner quotes Ayn Rand as having said in a novel, warned against the sin of forgiveness, and he wonders if we should never forgive someone who acts against principle.
Yes, objectivism would say forgiveness is a sin if you accept it as a principle. In other words, if it's synonymous with compromise, turning the other cheek, allowing people to violate your rights. This does not mean that it is always wrong to forgive an individual, depending upon what it is he's done, whether atonement is possible, and whether he's given you any evidence that he has atoned. For instance, you cannot forgive somebody like Adolf Hitler, no matter if he comes to you and says, I'm sorry, I changed my mind. That is beyond the pale. But within a lesser scale of crime, assuming the person makes restitution where that's possible, and then gives you evidence that he really has atoned, then forgiveness on your part would amount to simply recognizing reality. But I have to stress that it is not enough to say, I'm sorry, I wish I hadn't done it. The person has to really demonstrate across a substantial period of time and in a whole variety of actions that he has so transformed his inner character as a result of the shock of the evil that he committed, that he is no longer the person who committed that kind of action. And in that context, I would say it's perfectly appropriate to forgive him, assuming that you have not lost an irreplaceable value in the process. But if he has cost you something irreplaceable to you, even if it's not a life. You were, I don't know, you were a dancer, and he broke your leg in such a way that you can never dance, and he's paid the full criminal fee, and imagine by some kind of incredible hypothesis that he's gone to a psychologist for 25 years and he's been entirely cured, and etc. and so on. You could still say theoretically this guy is no longer corrupt, but I personally will never forgive him because of the effects on my life, and you would have every right in the world. And in a case like that, I would think turning the other cheek would be positively immoral. I couldn't think of any more self-hating action. And in that way, forgiveness would be a sin. Yeah.
On behalf of the Ford Hall Forum, I'd like to thank Dr. Peacock for joining us once again.